Thanks, everybody, for waking up so early to hear my talk. So, ready to hear about a little crime this morning, huh? Well, let me start with some questions. Now, we're going to talk about a lot of different topics. We're going to talk about the darknet. We're going to talk about DevOps. We're going to talk about point of sale, malware. We're going to take a journey through many, many different parts. But let me ask, how many people here are familiar with the darknet? Come on, everybody here. Hands go up, a few hands. Okay. Anybody here use Tor? Anyone admitting to using Tor here? Okay. A few more hands go up. Yep. Okay. And let me ask this question. Is it illegal to be on the darknet? No, it's not illegal. I get that question a lot, though. People, I work a lot with criminal investigators as well, and a lot of them are not as used to being on the darknet as you guys are a sophisticated technical group. I get that question a lot. Let me ask you another question. Let's see what we think here. Is it illegal to use Tor? It's not illegal to use Tor. No, not at all. It's not illegal to be on the darknet, not illegal to use Tor. What's that? Well, that's a good point, actually. It's not illegal here where we're in. It is illegal in parts, or de facto, in parts of the world. We'll get you dragged away. But here, people are still allowed to use it, theoretically. Okay, good. All right, so we're going to start talking this morning about secure DevOps or darknet early breach detection. We're talking about breaches, too, this morning. So we're going to start by talking about a famous criminal prosecution, the Seleznev case. Anyone familiar with Roman Seleznev? He was heard the case of Roman Seleznev. It was a very famous takedown that was done recently. Anyone know where Roman was taken down? It was an international manhunt for Roman Seleznev, who was successfully captured and, as we'll say, convicted of criminal theft and fraud. He was taken down in the Maldives. That's the answer, the Maldives, after an international manhunt, a very interesting takedown. Anyway, we're going to learn a little bit about him. He was, his crimes were carding, skimming, always a favorite, and financial and high-tech fraud, that broad statute. And then we're going to do a little technical deep dive to see, you know, how they did it and look at some techniques. We're going to look at some password cracking and darknet acquisition and some point-of-sale RAM malware and skimmers, take a tour through those worlds. And then finally, we're going to wrap up by bringing it back to what we do every day, which is trying to do some responsible, hopefully, system administration and security and what everybody can do to prevent that from turning from an interesting talk into a nightmare in your own company. Okay. Convicted. Oh, my goodness. Here's Roman Seleznev. Roman led a great life. He's an interesting character. He had a number of aliases. He bankrupted a number of businesses. He started targeting businesses in the Seattle area. He actually started small with pizza parlors. It was pizza joints in the Seattle area found themselves targeted at their point-of-sale terminals, and credit cards stolen, and people that bought from the pizza parlors would quickly find their credit cards stolen and would end up bankrupting these small businesses, and they moved on to bankrupting larger businesses. His specialty was hacking point-of-sale computers, obviously the topic of our talk today. He was arrested in 2014 in the Maldives. He had almost 2 million credit card numbers with him when he was arrested. Now, how many of you guys carry around 2 million credit card numbers? Not too many. I have two, I think. I probably lost one, you know. But 2 million, 1.7 million. He was convicted on 38 counts for doing $170 million in damages. He probably did way more than that. And sentenced to 27 years plus a number, plus 14. And he's kind of a legendary figure because he actually was a great innovator and really developed the whole stolen credit card data business to a great extent. He was like one of the original carders. Carding, right? Anyone here heard of carding? Carding, sure, a few hands go up, a few heads nodding. We'll talk about carding, but basically the theft of credit cards and for the most part, selling them or dumping them on the dark net or, you know, for fun and profit. He was the top hacker at one point, and as many of you may know, he was the son of Valery Seleznev, who is a Russian parliament member. And here's a picture of Roman with one of his many cars in front of the Kremlin. So he had a lot of photos like this online. This was actually taken from the criminal complaint, one of many photos of himself that he displayed. So he was a great innovator. He was, this is the background here, is one of his sites instructing people, because he also had to develop the whole market and develop mules and things. So he had to instruct people in how to play their part in the crime, and here it is explaining to people how they can make money. So he's a great innovator, and he's now an inmate. From innovator to inmate, and here's a picture of one of the, this was the first prison where Roman was imprisoned. I thought that would be an interesting backdrop for this slide. Yeah, so I start with the end of the story, which is Roman Seleznev apprehended. Slide. Yeah, so I start with the end of the story, which is Roman Seleznev apprehended and imprisoned and convicted of his crime, basically. So things haven't turned out too well for Roman lately. Here are some of the here's some of the forensics that was used to capture him, just out of interest. These are also taken from the criminal complaint from prosecutors. This shows a Tor browser was the last user activity when they captured him. This was not as dramatic as a takedown of some of the other fascinating takedowns, like Ross Ulbricht, another famous takedown right in the public library, the Glen Park branch in San Francisco, where they have to dramatically capture the laptop open in order to preserve the admin account. This one, they just grabbed him. They had a lot of other data, but he was open to Tor browser at the time. Here's some of the forensic activity, and here's some of the other forensic evidence that was introduced in the case at the time as well, bitmap and other things. Just kind of interesting. So criminal carding. All right, I think a few people said they were familiar with criminal carding. Not too many people admit to knowing much about criminal carding, but here's a famous darknet hidden service site from Rescator, another famous carder. And it's basically buying, selling, and trading online credit card data stolen generally from large retailer data breaches. And we're going to talk about some very large retailer data breaches, all of which you guys would be very familiar with. Their names are very common, and they're very well-known breaches that we're going to talk about today. And the cards fetch about $10 to $25 on the open market for a stolen number. They're bundled in packs of 10,000 and sold through accounts like Rescator. You create an account, go online, they create what they call dumps of stolen credit cards, and you go in and bid and buy packs of 10,000 or so at a time. You then use them to buy gift cards or electronics at retail stores, and then you fraudulently resell them on the internet and have the items shipped to what's called a reshipper, who gets a cut of it as well. So that's how the crime works, basically. It's huge business. It continues to be a huge, big business today. Anyone who goes to a large retail store, which we're going to see, is subject to this crime because they target the largest retailers. Okay. So that's a little bit of background. Now we're going to do the technical deep dive. So here's a little history of data breach events. It's a select history. I included, these are all extremely well-known data breaches, nothing new about them. One interesting point that might go into this this timeline is that in 2017, the first settlement was noted that included mandatory darknet monitoring. So these large retailers and large companies are now starting to be subject to mandatory court-ordered darknet monitoring because it's so well known and so clear that this data is all dumped on the darknet. And indeed, if they had gone out on the darknet, they would have discovered the breach a lot earlier because the evidence from the darknet shows that this data was dumped out there a lot earlier than the breaches were originally otherwise discovered. So yeah, December 2017, the first mandatory darknet reporting. Here's a here's the results of an actual darknet search, and this is a tool that I use a lot when I'm doing my darknet searches, but this is the type of tool that we use when searching the darknet to find Stolen credit cards, all kinds of other things, references to large companies. Anyone recognize what this may be? This is like an eye chart, so like you kind of need a telescope to see this slide, but anyone recognize what that is up on the screen there? CVV, I heard a few people say CVV, that's right. These are stolen credit cards there. This is your credit card data. And if the credit card number's not enough, they've got the CVVs in clear text there for you. Oh, and they've also got the expiration date. Anyone wonder if their credit cards are up on the dark net? I'll tell you that for sure they are. And here's just an example of a recent search I did that turns up thousands and thousands and thousands of these. Carters dump a sample so that you can look at the sample and test the quality of their credit cards. So that's an... Anyone know what this is? Anyone seen this type of... This clue on the screen? Okay, who said skimmer? Come on, you cheated. Okay. Yes, it's a skimmer. Skimmers are like the Model T Fords of the point-of-sale breach malware world. They were the original devices that one by one were stuck on like ATMs, gas point-of-sale devices were a favorite. The only difference between skimmers, these are little physical devices, very small. This is from my work at Alameda County Sheriff's Office. We got one of these in there the other day, and I took a photograph of it. It was discovered at a major retailer. Where you can see the slot where you stick in your credit card. This one is split in half. So these essentially do the same thing one by one that malware does by the thousands at a time at large retailers. But these are still in use today, still criminal gangs that travel up and down Highway Route 5 on the West Coast and elsewhere in the U.S. on Friday nights out of their headquarters in Anaheim, California. Stick these all up and down the West Coast. Stick a laptop in a rental car in a nearby parking lot, and the skimmers communicate throughout the weekend. Every single credit card or card that's stuck in them, they record, and then the criminals return on Sunday night, pull the skimmer off, pull the laptop off, drive the rental car back to the airport, fly back down to Anaheim, rinse and repeat every single weekend. From now till the end of time, they're still out there, skimmers. Fascinating crime. Okay, how they did it. We're going to use Burp Suite. Anyone here use Burp Suite? Come on. Everybody uses Burp Suite, right? Oh, a few people admitting to it. This is, you can get a community edition free out on the internet. It's a fascinating tool. I'm not going to ask if it's legal to use Burp Suite. That will be for extra credit afterwards. So you can use Burp Suite to do some password cracking. What's even easier is just go out on the darknet and buy or grab a bunch of credentials. These events, these large retailer breaches, start with the attacker gaining credentials from generally from a breach at an outside vendor. So in the case of the hack that we're going to look at, it's a major, major retailer. And the origin of their attack started with one of their suppliers who had credentials into their own system. So one way or another, you acquire those credentials. Now we take a pause to inquire into my background. Who am I? A little bit. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at Alameda County Sheriff's Office. Work for a major company in downtown San Francisco as well. Formerly a senior manager at Putnam Investments. Also at Bank of New York Mellon. These are some of the companies that I work for, published a lot on the darknet, on legal topics. Those are my two specialties. And here are some of the things I do, teach wayward teenagers how to code, trying to keep them out of trouble in my spare time. So that's a little bit about me. Okay. So this retailer hack overview. Here's another picture of a Hidden Service Tor darknet site where carters dump their wares. And what we can see here is an example of, they call them bases, when they steal a huge amount of information and dump it in the darknet, they call it a dump. And each individual set of credit cards is called a base. And they name their base. And this one You see the name of what this one's named, European Sanctions, and it advertises a valid rate of 100%. So they're interested in the quality of their sales. And they also have another base name, American Sanctions, that they name out here, and advertise that they have not only track one but track two, as well as state and zip, and they don't give any replacements either. So this is from 2014. They target large retailers because they can install malware on thousands of point-of-sale systems in a single swoop. What an advancement over placing physical skimmers one by one on bank ATMs and gas machines. And they grab a large number of customer credit and debit card accounts and millions of customer email addresses. And this particular hack is one of the largest hacks in history. I'm sure you've heard a lot about it. And it's a retailer where probably everybody here shopped last week. Okay, this settlement was $198 million in total when all was said and done. We read a lot about breaches at the time. It takes a while to unwind them and figure out where they go. And then they have phase one, two, and three. So they often drag on longer than we heard about them. This one undoubtedly people heard about a few years ago. If you knew the name of the retailer, you'd say, oh, yeah, that was a few years ago. But it had subsequent phases of the hack went on. And then the civil settlement dragged on and was only settled last year, as I said. This was the settlement that included mandatory darknet reporting because all of this data was dumped on the darknet and was available there so much longer before it was found otherwise. So when you go back to your organizations, you might ask yourself if a darknet search might yield something now that would tell you information that can about your breaches, if you have any. They can be very expensive and time-consuming to find out otherwise. So they ended up paying $136 million to Visa and MasterCard. They had only $27 million in fraudulent charges that they reimbursed, which is a tiny number in comparison to their bank fees. They had some civil settlements with consumers above and beyond fraudulent charges. A little bit of legal fees, $16 million there. And this was only the first wave of their civil settlements. So here was the timeline. Started in April 2013 with password cracking, as I mentioned, just to review. And account acquisition from the darknet, meaning credentials, meaning login credentials. By account acquisition, I mean they went out there and got some account credentials from employees of the supplier and of the retail hack, and their clear text passwords. And by the way, usually if they're targeting employees of a certain company, like maybe any of your companies, you guys might be targeted, they're going to typically grab all of your credentials for all of your logins across all your platforms and all your clear text passwords at the same time, which is a kind of a chilling thought. And then by July 2013, they had launched a zero-day attack to exploit the vulnerability. They were able to jump the barrier between the vendor and they got into the retailer system. By the following spring, they had successfully installed malware on over 2,200 self-checkout terminals at this retailer where you probably shopped last week. The malware reads the clear text payment card data so that people that developed the operating systems for point-of-sale devices felt that there was no likelihood that anyone was ever going to look at data between the time that it was read and the time that it was transmitted to the server. So they thought that transmitting it in clear text was a fine plan. So it reads the clear text payment card data in random access memory on the point-of-sale terminal, and it uses regex to grab that PCI track data and send it to the attacker server. So that's basically how it works. Very simple. We're going to take a little bit of a look at it. And then by June through November of 2014, those credit cards were out on the darknet in Carter forms being sold in packs of 10,000, as I mentioned. This breach was publicly detected by a journalist, Brian Krebs. Anyone here read Brian Krebs? He's great, right? He's always got something exciting going on, right? He wrote a lot about this hack. And for heaven's sakes, he was the one that found out about it because the number one victim of this is really banks to a great extent, as well as the retailers. But banks don't want to publicize this. We don't hear about this from banks. So it was somebody at a bank that was processing these that picked up the phone and called Brian Krebs and said, hey, you might be interested to know, all these credit cards that we're finding are converging. Because how do banks find the credit cards that are being stolen? Anyone have any idea how these are actually found? Yeah. What's that? Well, that's true. But the difficult thing is figuring out, you're absolutely correct, is figuring out what is the common retailer. You know, I mean, banks get fraudulent charges like all day, every day. And they're just getting more and more and more. It's going up, not getting less. But where's that common point? So they have to do a lot of data science correlation and figuring it out. But once they do, anyone know what banks do once they figure out? They go and buy back those card dumps themselves. The banks are the main customers for those online darknet card dumps. They don't want anyone to know about that, naturally. It just seems like it's encouraging crime, right? So someone who is busy searching the darknet carding forums and paying back these carders to buy back their stolen credit cards, banks buy them back, tipped off Brian Krebs and said, hey, there's a huge breach at retailer X, but nobody's talking about it. And better believe retailer X did not disclose this themselves. But that wasn't the end of the breach. It was widely reported. It then went on to a later phase, which was phishing, because all those credentials also, they were able to find email addresses. And all of our email addresses are very valuable for future phishing campaigns. So those are also bought and paid for on the darknet. And by the way, in October 2017, a lot of that breach data was still on the darknet available. All the customers' personally identifiable information. Okay, so we talked a little bit about how it starts, the skimmers. Here is a screenshot for anybody that wants to know of the consent agreement for the company that requires them to monitor the darknet. Point four, the company shall maintain and periodically assess partnership with a dark web mining service for retailer name information. So they're now legally required by law to constantly buy services from darknet mining companies and search for their data, which is probably a really good thing because in comparison to what they're paying the vendor, they're saving themselves a heck of a lot of money and saving their consumers. And here's the case citation where this can be found. Okay, password cracking. So here we got Burp Suite. And as I mentioned, you can download it free. You can download it right now if you wanted to. Burp Suite has a community edition. They also have an enterprise edition like a lot of people. I asked this a minute ago. Anyone here have Burp Suite? Anyone here, organization pays for Burp Suite to their knowledge? Right, a lot of organizations use Burp Suite Enterprise Edition as part of their CSERT, their intrusion detection programs. So a lot of your companies may already have a license for Burp Suite if you're interested. PortSwigger is one of the parts of that, and this is a screenshot of that. I use this sometimes in training, hands-on training to teach people how to do this. Here's another great website, DVWA. DVWA, this is another important security one. Anyone know what DVWA stands for? Anyone use this before? This is Damn Vulnerable Web App. This is a web app. It is damn vulnerable. This is actually a web app that's used intentionally to be able to test for security programs. It's a legitimate program, and it's the only way to test whether your brute forcing is working or not. So it's a web app that's intentionally built with a lot of vulnerabilities, and here I've provided the login. So what you do is you go into Burp Suite, and essentially you need to set it up with your to configure it to work with localhost initially and set it up with your company's IP address. As you can see, I provide the configuration here. And then you go in and feed it certain, what you want to do is you want to feed it a rainbow table, a file of possible passwords. And this shows how to set it up. You pop on the intercept is on, and you intercept that traffic that's coming from your company's website here. And once you've got that, you click on the actual web name, the URL that you want to test, which that could be your company or your own personal website, whichever one you want to test and try to brute force. So what you're going to do is you're going to feed in a table of possible passwords, and you're going to get Burp Suite is going to repetitively feed your file until it hits the password that's going to work for this account. And here you click on Spider, and these are basically parameters in the exact way that you need to set it up. These slides will be available later for anyone that's interested in trying this at home. And finally, you want to save your whole rainbow table here under your payload sets. Load it up. You can see select file on the side. You load up your, so you want to go out on the internet if you don't have a rainbow file being a file of known possible passwords. You can go out and find them. They're easily available for a quick Google search on rainbow table. You're going to load it into Burp Suite here. And then you just click and go. And in a minute, it's going to run through all the incorrect passwords. It's going to feed it into account login. So you're going to pick a website that has an account login. Most organizations have a private account login. It's going to feed it, and this one is going to show, oh, my goodness, what is the password for this account? Can anybody see on the screen? What is the one that does not have incorrect checked? Oh, my goodness, it's password. The password is password. Never would have guessed, right? Oh, my goodness. People use the most common passwords all the time. I chose this as an example because this is very typical. Sometimes you don't even have to use Burp Suite. Just go in. In the lab where I work, we play a game with each other when we're recovering data. Often we have to recover files and capture data of just simply guessing the password on the files. Most common, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So works every time. Anyway, with something more sophisticated, this will work. Okay, so that's technique one. You can try that at home. It's a very interesting technique. It's not very hard. This one we're going to do darknet credential acquisition. That we already talked about a little bit. Anyone recognize this guy? He was in the news a lot a while ago. Is this Mubarak? This is Egypt Mubarak, right? He was the president of Egypt. He's behind bars there. Things aren't looking too good for him. Anyone remember? Mubarak famously shut down the internet in Egypt for a week. That was a while ago. Anyone remember why he did that? Oh, what's that? Exactly, Arab Spring. It was that time when there was uprising in his land, and a lot of videos and photos of the violence were getting out. And a lot of people don't realize the extent to which the internet is choked and controlled in many countries. But so he was so frustrated that he couldn't shut down those videos getting out. Those videos were coming out over Tor. Tor, the tool that's the darknet tool, basically. So we talked about Tor a little bit before. Tor is freeware. Anybody can download it. You can go to it right now and download it. And for many people, Tor is the equivalent of the darknet. It isn't really. It's just one of the tools that's used on the darknet. But it's one that's used most frequently. And in 2011, he shut down the internet, reportedly because he could not shut down Tor and all the videos and images that were being sent out at that time. Anyone who remembers, there was a lot of unrest. Oh, my goodness. Who's this guy? Come on. Anybody recognize him? Edward Snowden, right? What's that he's got on the back of his laptop? I would look a little bit closer. What is that? You can see what that is there? Next to the EFF sticker, it's the Tor sticker, right? This famous picture of Edward Snowden, the back of his laptop's got a Tor sticker. Edward Snowden also used Tor to exfiltrate his information. So anyone who's not familiar with Tor may be familiar with these famous incidents and people that use Tor to exfiltrate data. On the right hand of this screen is some of that information that Snowden exfiltrated. Anyone recognize this? This is a famous slide presentation named after an animal. It was egotistical giraffe. This was a National Security Agency slide presentation, part of Snowden's trove that was exfiltrated. And I included it here as an example because a lot of agencies have tried to break Tor and have supposedly been unable to do that. And this was a slide presentation demonstrating the work that had been done to try to break Tor. at that time. Darknet, some fundamentals for people that aren't that familiar with the darknet. Darknet, Tor is an anonymous communication system, right? And it's not the only one, though. There's a number of them. You've got Yondo, Yondoneme, I2P, ZeroNet. There's a bunch of them out there. Tor is the best known and one of the largest. So briefly, here's how it works. Tor is a number of things. It includes a volunteer network of around 6,900 servers around the world where volunteers sign up, and it bounces your traffic typically through three relays, and so that none of the relays knows the origin of the traffic or the destination. So it keeps you completely anonymous and further wraps your traffic in layers of encryption, which, however, is unwrapped at the end, so your traffic passes clear text through the final hop, which a lot of people don't realize. Here is a picture of Tor browser. This is former Tor browser. So it's just a browser. It's just like Firefox, or it's based on Firefox, Chrome, or any browser that you might use. Free to download. You can download it right now. Use it for search. This is a slide showing a breakdown of traffic over Tor. So this was done by an academic researcher, but originally, and this shows currently the amount of traffic. What this slide shows is that the majority of traffic that's actually passing over Tor is criminal in nature. But Tor has other uses besides for criminal use. Some people here said that they use Tor. What do people use Tor for? That are for legitimate uses. Anyone know legitimate uses of Tor?
Privacy.
What's that?
Privacy.
Privacy, right, exactly. Maybe you're visiting websites and you don't want to wake up every morning like I do with your name and address sold to every website in town, right? So this prevents websites from harvesting your personal information. Ordinary people that just want to go and browse the web without having all their PII stolen and sold. How about reading newspapers that are behind a paywall, right? If you go out on Tor, sometimes you can get around their paywall. A lot of people use it for that. Maybe protect your privacy in another country or something. So there's a lot of legitimate uses of Tor, but the empirical information shows that, in fact, the majority of traffic that actually comes through Tor is criminal in nature. Here is a slide that is another eye chart. Nobody could possibly read this slide, that explains how Tor hidden services. So aside from Tor browser, there's over 33 known applications of Tor. And hidden services are what most people think of as the darknet, because the dark markets are often put out on here. This slide is mainly meant to convey that hidden services and dark markets are complex. They're essentially set up behind two different layers of three relay hops, so that neither the client, who is typically the buyer on a dark market site, like a carding site, and the seller, like Rescator or Roman Seleznev, neither the buyer nor the seller know each other. They typically use Bitcoin, as you know, which is, of course, not really anonymous, but a bit harder to trace. So this is how a Tor hidden service works. Somewhat complicated. So the darknet, we're going to give a few definitions here for people that aren't that familiar with the darknet. It's an overlay network. It's just an overlay network of the internet, basically. It's not a separate network. It's just an overlay of the internet. It's an alternative internet addressing scheme to DNS, and you cannot trace the IP address, which makes it difficult for law enforcement to apprehend criminals. Here's the Department of the Navy. Anybody know why the Department of the Navy's up here?
They funded it.
Exactly. Tor, the darknet, was originally funded by the U.S. Navy. Here's Paul Syverson, one of the original inventors of Tor, the onion routing, and he still works for the U.S. Navy. He was actually one of my thesis advisors for my PhD. So Tor is a complicating thing. We're not going to go through it in too much detail. It's a network of people, a nonprofit organization, an organization of servers, so it can be kind of complicated. And it also is not a number of things that are named after it, like Tor Mail or all sorts of things that have the word Tor in it that are kind of knockoffs that are not actually Tor. Here's a quick timeline. It was invented in the 1990s by the U.S. Navy. It was taken public in 2004. In 2006, the Tor project was incorporated in Massachusetts. And today, there's about 6,300 Tor relays worldwide with about 2 million sessions daily at 275 gigabits a second, more or less. So that's the background on that. Quick, we're just going to run through the PosRAM mouse scraper software. This, for anyone who's interested, gives like a little bit of a deep dive into that. This malware is kind of fascinating, actually. It's simple, but it's grown, and the Carters steal it from each other and then improve on it. So now it's got all sorts of quality checks built into it and all sorts of features and functionality that's all controlled remotely when it's on your retailer's point-of-sale terminal. These predominantly use Windows OS, and this is something that would really benefit from system administrators' closer attention and knowledge. The captured data is sent to attacker servers, so we include some examples here. And in this retailer hack, they used BlackPause, is a well-known to reverse engineers available out on the internet. Pretends to be a component of antivirus, of course, the most typical thing. It enumerates all the processes that are running on the infected system, and then it scans the process memory for track 1 and 2 credit card data. This is a screenshot of BlackPause credit card data output. It's very familiar. So if you ran this malware, you would see this output. Decibel is a similar thing that I reverse engineer here too, coded in VBScript, oh my goodness, C, C++, or Delphi, that once the source code has been leaked online, it uses the HTTP post requests to do the data exfiltration. And this is not cached, not saved in history, and there's no restrictions on data sending length typically for this data, which makes it all the easier to grab. So briefly, it infects the system using a drive-by download attack, which we won't go into here, but you can see it can take several months for an attacker to work their way into the part of the system where they can quickly perform a drive-by download attack. At startup, it checks for reverse engineering tools. It evades detection and terminates itself if it finds effective tools, which it typically does not. It installs itself under user profile, under this file name, and then audits the infected system, determines all sorts of information about them, OS, version, everything they need to know. They also retrieve the name of the anti-malware solution, and they exfiltrate that all to their remote server along with all the credit card data. So that's, in a nutshell, how the software works. Here's an example of it. Here's checking the presence of debugging tools. Again, these will all be available online afterwards. And it then audits the infected system. This is an actual example of it auditing the infected system that it runs through quickly while you're waiting in line to buy your, you know, groceries or your, you know, whatever you may be buying. It's running through these checks. Make sure that it's functioning optimally so that the minute you stick in your credit card, it's not going to waste any time. Then it's going to check for anti-malware solutions. Here it's checking to see if it's got any. Oh, there aren't any. Too bad. And then the next part of it, I won't go through all of these in detail, but it calls these various classes to grab the data, perform a loop through the data to skip any of the data that is not interesting to it, and then check to make sure that it's not on a blacklist, processes it. Here again are the screenshots. And then finally, it uses regexes to match track 1 and 2 credit card data so that it can identify it. It's got a built-in loon validation mechanism. For anybody that works in retail, you know that's a credit card validation mechanism because they only want the highest quality dumps when they sell them. And finally, they exfiltrate that. And here again is an example of running through the loon validation here. So it doesn't get any bad credit cards, fake credit cards. So that's basically how it works. Okay, and to wrap up, what can be done about this? There's all sorts of things that actually can be done about it. And a lot of it starts with you guys in system administration, actually. Anyone here work on point of sale operating systems? No hands going up. Not as many point-of-sale systems out there. The number of them in comparison to other systems is small. this is a field that is very rich for improvement. We find inadequate network segregation. That's typical. But also, some of these retailers have a practice of entering credit card data in other departments other than at the point of sale. That's a bad thing. And they have very weak third-party vendor oversight. But, you know, I'm going to run through quickly in the last, 2 minutes, a bunch of things that people can do. I'm not going to dwell on them because a lot of them are typical things that you guys know about. But as we know, the problem is that it costs more money to implement a lot of these things than the money that's being stolen or the fines. So, and also nobody wants to do anything to slow down that line at the, you know, at the store that you're waiting in. And all of these things could also potentially slow things down. They either cost time or money. But here's some very impactful things. Restricting physical access to point-of-sale devices is easier said than done because we're all standing in line. There's self-checkout terminals where you're meant to approach the point-of-sale terminal. But restricting that physical access is crucial because that's one of the most typical ways of installing malware as well. Encrypting the point-of-sale apps, the communication between the app and the data device, storage, and then deleting the store cardholder data, because why are retailers holding on to that data anyway? So these show some policy-based things that can be done, restricting physical repairs and upgrades access, deleting the cardholder data, and implementing point-of-sale logs and audit trails. Again, these are the point-of-sale, the operating systems that are on those little devices at retailers have their own operating systems, and they are not hardened. And some resources. So that's basically it.